Oh, baby, thank you so much.
Oh, hey, you better be back here next year.
Oh, yes, I am. I'm so glad you won. If you need any help while you're in town...
Gypsy, Betty Jean Woolley of Anchorage, one of the 13 contestants in the 1980 Mrs. Alaska pageant and not one of the five finalists, was congratulating the lucky winner, whose name we'll learn shortly. The five finalists, selected from the pack of 13 by Saturday night, competed against each other in swimsuits and evening gowns and in answering a question put to them by the judges concerning the unique qualities of the Alaskan woman. They ranged in age from 19 to 47, were either from Anchorage or Fairbanks, and were still in their evening gowns when the winners were announced. Cindy Baldwin in a strapless white gown with a sequin top, Linda Bernhardt in baby blue, Tammy Borden in fire engine red held up by spaghetti straps, Ruth Van Veldhuizen in yellow organdy with flounces over the shoulders, and Joy Wynn in a slinky black dress that went over one shoulder and off the other.
The additional prizes included her evening gown, a t-shirt, the state costume, a gift certificate from a wig shop, and a modeling and self-improvement class.
And you know, just by the quality of women who have passed through this pageant, each and every one of them in their own way. It's very special and only be the winner of the pageant. And you have an offer. Second runner-up, in this case, is Joy Wynn number 11 of Anchorage.
Well, I feel that it's a wonderful, you know, thing to be in this, and I'm glad that my daughter had an opportunity to participate with me.
Have you been in contests like this before at all?
No, not really. During high school, when I was in the strict girls academy, I was in one, and then I had to get out because the nun didn't like the concept of the bathing suit.
So I had to get out of that when I was only about 15, something like this.
All right, our second runner-up is Ruth Van Amazing Mesa.
Why did you decide to enter this pageant? So I thought it would give me an opportunity to emphasize the positive aspects of being a Mrs. And also because I am an Alaskan and proud of it and would have enjoyed the chance to further represent our state.
How did you feel about the various segments of the competition? There was a swimsuit competition, an evening gown, and answering a question.
Mm-hmm. How did I feel about it? Well, we were told that it was not to be a beauty contest as such, and that modeling in a swimsuit was just merely a formality. So I'm not sure why it was even included.
What did it feel like being Mrs. Alaska?
Marvelous. I'm stunned, I'm delighted, I'm thrilled, and I'm very proud to be able to represent the state.
Why did you decide to enter the pageant?
This year I'm going to be 40, and my philosophy is life begins at 40, and I thought this would be a fun way to get it started.
Was this a surprise to actually win the competition?
Yes, it was. Any one of the 13 contestants could have represented the state.
Linda Bernhardt, Mrs. Alaska 1980, who will get to represent the state. One of the 13 who will not get to represent the state was disqualified from the competition, Betty Jean Woolley, who calls herself Gypsy.
What happened, Gypsy?
Well, I was accepted as a contestant, and I am a divorcee, and at the time I applied as a contestant, I had let them know that I'm by myself, but I'm still the Mrs. in my family. So I wanted to represent my state and the rest of the people, the ladies. And they disqualified me. They said, too bad, go get married. You know? So I just wanted to stay and watch the rest of the girls and work with them. And I was really rooting for Linda, you know. I was very disappointed, very disappointed.
There were five judges for the competition, one from Barrow, two from Fairbanks, and two from Anchorage. One of the Anchorage judges was Rita Gravel, wife of Senator Mike.
What's it like being a judge?
Karen, it's very difficult. All the ladies were very talented and quick with good answers, very well-rounded, even if they were 19 or I think the oldest lady was 47. They had a good grasp on Alaska. It was difficult, truly difficult.
Have you ever been in a contest something like this yourself?
Yes, a long time ago in 1958, I was Miss Fur Rendezvous. It was the year of statehood, and it was the most fantastic year of my life. And I might mention something to the girls and the women out there in the audience, is if you have a chance to get into these contests, sometimes in this day and age, we kind of say, oh, isn't that ridiculous? But you know, if I hadn't have had the training of being pushed out on the stage and say, now we will hear a few words from Miss Alaska, and if I hadn't had to associate with the older people, I just found it much easier to fit into the life that I'm required to do now, having had these opportunities when I was 19 years old. So I'd say, gals, get into it. It's great fun.
Have you thought of going back into it yourself?
No, I really, really haven't. I don't think that's too high on Mike's list.
The 1980 Mrs. Alaska pageant at the Travelers Inn in Fairbanks. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The 360-mile-long North Slope Hall Road is the subject of a continuing controversy over whether and how much should be open to the public. Native and environmental groups have supported restricting public access, while business interests have encouraged its opening. And various pieces of legislation have attempted to settle the issue. During last spring's legislative session, Representative Charlie Parr of Fairbanks sponsored a bill to open the full length of the road to public use. That bill was initially passed, then blocked in a vote of reconsideration. Another bill, introduced by Senator Bob Bennett of Fairbanks, Senate Bill 289, with a parallel bill number 503 in the House, is still being considered. The Bennett bill would open the Hall Road as far north as Dietrich and states that the road shall be open to the general public in the same manner as any other state highway. Earlier this month, at the urging of Senator John Sackett of Galena, a meeting was held in Fairbanks of people representing various groups with a vested interest in the Hall Road and the legislation concerning its future use and access. The intent was to determine if the groups could come together to find some common grounds on the issue. John Adams, executive director for the Fairbanks Environmental Center, explains the process of organizing the gatherings.
The Tenenbaum Chiefs Conference and the Environmental Center then approached the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, who liked the idea, and we set up a series of meetings, two meetings, that were attended by representatives from the Chamber, from the Environmental Center, the Tenenbaum Chiefs, Northwest Gas, the North Slope Borough, Sohio BP, and I believe that's it.
There were two meetings, the first on Thursday, February 14th, and the second the following Tuesday, February 19th, both at the Chamber of Commerce. The Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce chose Bob Thomas, chairperson of the Transportation Committee, to represent their interests.
Arlene Klein was brought in to monitor the meeting because of the explosive nature of the meeting between the groups. It became pretty apparent right off the bat that there was very little common ground among the groups. And what the technique she used was to give each of the groups about 10 minutes to just basically brainstorm what their feelings and what their concerns were, and then went through the points and found there were three that we felt were somewhat common ground.
The three so-called consensus points reached at the first meeting on February 14th were as follows. One, travel on the road should be limited to industrial and commercial use. As defined by state law, that would limit use of the road to oil and gas, mineral and agricultural development. Tour buses would be allowed, but tourists traveling in private vehicles would not. Two, recreational off-road vehicles should be prohibited within a zone of 5 miles on either side of the road or the pipeline, whichever width is greater. And three, that hunting should be forbidden in the same zone. It was expected that the various groups involved in the meeting, parties to the consensus points, would incorporate those points into their lobbying efforts, statements, and positions on the Hall Road. However, the consensus achieved at that February 14th session was far from firm. A second meeting was set for February 19th. In the interim, each representative, according to a statement by moderator Arlene Klein, president of the League of Women Voters, was to obtain approval of the draft statement of the points from their board of directors or officers as required by their respective organizations. John Adams describes what happened at that second meeting.
We refined the wording of a draft which came out of the first meeting. Essentially, we dotted I's and crossed T's, and everyone agreed to the final language. And then the statement was typed at the the Chamber of Commerce office and distributed by the League of Women Voters to the press and to the legislature. Shortly thereafter, the chamber apparently changed its mind on the points of consensus.
According to Arlene Klein, no one from the chamber contacted her regarding the changed position. But doubts, according to Chamber Representative Bob Thomas, occurred before that second meeting, and a change was made to accommodate that uneasiness.
It became apparent that a time frame couldn't be agreed to. And so finally, at the last meeting, it was determined that the consensus points would just apply for the period of construction on the natural gas line. At that time, the chamber, in fact, at the end of that meeting, February the 19th, that was Tuesday?
That's right.
Okay. The chamber, at least I felt, that we had a consensus of the 3 points were in consensus on it. And I don't think there would have been any problem with that.
But the chamber felt that there was a problem, that their basic position concerning the Hall Road was misrepresented to the media and to the legislature.
Those consensus points became positions, a joint position, and that really wasn't the case. It came out that the chamber supported not opening the Hall Road, and that simply wasn't the case. The chamber did support opening the Hall Road, but had, at least I had, agreed for the chamber that we would include those three consensus points in any support that we had. And so basically our position was going to be that we supported opening up the Hall Road, we supported Bennett's bill, and we wanted to have that decision made now, and that during the construction period of the natural gas line, we recognized there could be a need for closure of the road to the general public for safety reasons.
And so, not wanting to appear to support closure of the road, as the Fairbanks Environmental Center and the Tanana Chiefs Conference, both signatories to this consensus point, had advocated in the past, the chamber withdrew its support of the consensus.
So is it actually not that the chamber disagrees with those three consensus points, but that the chamber doesn't want to go on record as appealing to be against opening the Hall Road?
That's essentially it.
But the action taken by the chamber to satisfy its members has upset both Klein, who felt that all parties had acted in good faith, and the Environmental Center's Adams.
We are a little bit confused and very disappointed by that. We felt that the discussions and the resulting consensus points were a real landmark, not only in the context of the Hall Road issue, but also because it was the first time, really, that those groups, which often have widely diverging opinions and positions on issues, had gotten together and talked and had productive sessions and, in fact, agreed on some points regarding a very controversial issue. And I really hope that we're not back to ground zero.
But that's just where those traditional antagonists may be. Asked if she foresaw more meetings to attempt to reconcile the differences, Arlene Klein said that she didn't think that would happen. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Dear Chris, for me, letter writing is essential, right up there with inhaling, exhaling, and eating. In fact, at times, I worry that if I don't put down on paper what's happening in my heart and my head, I just might disappear. Letter writing is so safe, so satisfying, such a marvelous outlet. Perchance, persistent letter writers are actually cowards. I find it much easier to say something in print than to state my views in person. Not seeing the response of the recipient spares one the gut wrench of experienced exposure. For me, letter writing is a way of life. Considering options, making plans, finding solutions, even dreaming of future accomplishments are all done in the form of letters, mailed or mental.
The letter writer who's speaking is Edith Rohde of Fairbanks, usually referred to as Edie, author of a book of letters entitled Letters from Alaska.
When you started writing your letters from Alaska, were they really written as letters or as something you might publish?
No, they were written with a column in mind, and yet when I wrote them, I thought how much they sounded like my letters home. And when I took them to the Newsminer, the title I had was not very impressive, and
why do we live here or something like that. And Kent Sturgis, the managing editor, said, well, you know, we've got to get something snappier. And I laughed and said, well, no, we could just run them as if they were letters home. And he said, no, you couldn't. I said, you want to bet I couldn't? Which I could do. So I had six of them. I took them home and rewrote them as letters.
But you seem to have a certain attitude toward letters and what letters are. Or is that, again, a fiction of the need for the column?
No. As a matter of fact, the reason I was able to say to him with confidence, I can make them letters, was because in these particular letters, or with these subjects, I was slanting the entire thing toward explaining life here to somebody else. So making them a letter was actually not only possible, it was almost the way that I had written them, in thinking in terms of, all right, what would people think of as amusing, or how would I point up the humorous aspects of this particular thing to someone else.
But not all of her letters deal with Alaskan-only phenomena, that is, things such as Viz Queen, shell houses, or ice fog. Take her letter on laundromats.
Dear sis, here I sit in the laundromat trying to think of ways to cheer myself up. Surely there is no more odious task in the whole wide world than doing the laundry. What can I do to brighten up the chore? Suppose I waltzed in one night smiling. Now that right there is enough to blow everyone's mind. A smile in the laundromat? What next? I'd even go further. I would say right out loud something like, oh, how I do enjoy doing the laundry. I'd sing, be pleasant, the whole nine yards. Imagine the looks of disbelief and astonishment, the gasps, the skepticism. People would move away from me suspiciously. Hey, that's one way of getting enough machines, dryers, and clothes folding space on a crowded day. Trouble is, I'd probably have to do the laundry at a different establishment each time. The management would assume I was a dingbat and try to discourage my presence. When I write, I tend to try to write actually write to my parents or to the rest of the family. I don't want to write a gloomy letter. I mean, we're too distant, and there isn't anything they could do anyway. So I was trying anyway to write, you know, perky or positive kinds of things.
Rhody says that the book's illustrator, the late Bill Berry, referred to the volume as the story of a woman coping. Is your sequel to this going to be a volume of I Have Coped?
I have been looking into having water put in my house, and someone said, you can't do that unless you write a sequel. In other words, the fact that I was managing in less primitive circumstances. But I think I have gotten to the point where it ceased to be as amusing.
Though it ceased to be amusing for the author, the experiences she has written about will continue to offer a vicarious amusement for her readers. Take the letter about the death of her car.
I had written a column saying how life wasn't all bad because my car was running, and almost instantaneously my car quit running. So I actually did a column on the death of the car, or actually it was called A Meaningful Relationship, and in the process I described it. Just like in the movies, it was love at first sight. We were meant for each other. It was a perfect size for my needs. It was stately, unusual, attractive, sensible, sturdy, spacious, capable, charming, and strong. The ideal car. All right. So it was really a funky little battered-up, crabapple green cracker box with several dents and a radio that only worked when you parked in front of the station's transmitter. But for years, we went almost everywhere together. When it was down, I was down. I understood its idiosyncrasies and too often made allowances for its shortcomings. We went through a lot together and always did our best to keep each other going. We were friends. Now I'm on my own. I've got this other car, but it's just a car.
Edith Rhody of Fairbanks, whose chronicle of coping with life in the North is entitled Letters from Alaska, Hazards and Humor of Life in Suburbia, published last year by That New Publishing Company. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Doug Duffett, pastor of the Bible Baptist Church, is the chairperson of the Fairbanks chapter of the Moral Majority, an organization that has been accused of railroading delegates at the February 21st District 20 Republican caucuses. However, the group, led by Jerry Prevost of Anchorage, contends that they do not endorse specific candidates, but serve an educational function. I asked Duffett to explain just what the Moral Majority is.
It's an organization that, with a twofold purpose. Number one is to get people registered to vote. They took a survey in our country by an independent organization. I think it was about 50 million people who are qualified to vote are registered. And they did a study, this independent organization, to find out if we had an organized effort, how many of those folks could we get back into the public political workings? And they figured about 8 million. And they found out that a majority of those 8 million people that they could get back in are folks who are in our churches all over the country. And so, basically, a group of pastors organized this Mormon charter nationwide in Virginia. And since then, all 50 states have organized a state chapter. And our first goal is to get the people in our churches primarily registered to vote. We've been doing that in Fairbanks here.
Why is it called moral majority?
Well, we feel like that a majority of the people in our country are for basic morality. And we're against what's going on in our government and the issues such as gay rights and abortion and legalizing drugs and things like that. But those are moral issues that the majority of people are against those things. But we've never been able to have a united voice. We all feel like, what good is my one voice against the political structure? And they're going to do what they want to do anyhow.
So that, in effect, although your aim is to register people to get involved in the political process, you're also trying to influence them to support candidates that support your points of view. Is that correct?
No, we don't support candidates. The second purpose of Mormon Majority, in addition to registering people, is an educational institution. We will be able to give the folks who subscribe to our principles perhaps a voting record of the candidates, where they have stood on issues such as abortion. But the Mormon Majority itself does not take sides, either partisan Democrat or Republican, or individual candidates. We try to provide information, and the people can go from there.
But it's a fine line between political education and advocacy. The Moral Majority has not registered as a political action committee, according to Andy Barton, executive director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and they are not required to do so until they actually support candidates.
Admittedly, they're walking a fine line between voter education and trying to influence the outcome of elections. But nonetheless, until they specifically support or oppose candidates or statewide ballot propositions, we cannot require them to file.
However, the organization has been accused of trying to influence the outcome of an election. I asked Duffett about the organization's possible crossing of that fine line.
It's been said that in the Republican caucuses recently that the Moral Majority was quite active in encouraging people who were Reagan supporters to come attend the caucuses. Isn't that, in effect, supporting a candidate?
Well, let's put it this way. When we talk about Moral Majority, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about the actual executive board of Moral Majority, and then people who subscribe to the principles. Of course, now we have no control over them. We, as an official board, did not encourage people to vote for anybody. Now, it just happens to be that Mr. Reagan subscribes to Moral Majority principles. We don't subscribe to Mr. Reagan. He happens to go along with us.
Although Duffett went on to state that many of their members voted for Crane, who, quote, is a Christian, Crane received only 105 votes locally to the 1,838 for Reagan, and he denied charges of railroading delegates.
I did hear of some precincts where the liberals in control tried to railroad us. They tried to put their own candidates up and then call for a closing of nominations. None of our people were instructed to do that. We told them, you go ahead and let them nominate anybody they want to. But of course, we realized that we would have the numbers anyhow, and some of the precincts, we didn't get all Mormon Majority people in. But there was no mention. We didn't want a railroad. That's not what we're there for. We want to do everything is upright. We just happen to have the numbers, which is in parliamentary procedures. That's what counts.
Do you see some point where you or the Moral Majority may actively support certain candidates rather than, in effect, educating its members on where different candidates stand?
No, our stand is, and we have promised, I have promised people personally, as chairman of the Moral Majority in Fairbanks, we will never at all interfere with their voting. We will stay educational, and that is all.
In spite of Pastor Duffett's personal assurances, statewide Chairman Prevost may have different plans, according to the APOC's Barton.
Reverend Prevost said that at some future point, Moral Majority may wish to form a political action committee or a political group, and at that time, they would, in fact, register with the APOC.
Duffett contends that all of the Moral Majority's activities are for, quote, God and country, and though activities have centered around Republican candidates so far, beginning next week, they will start working on the Democrats. The Moral Majority was organized nationally in June 1979, in the state in December of 1979, and locally in January of this year.
Which really, to me, is evidence of God's hand in this thing, that so much has been accomplished in just a short time in organizing so many people.
and they hope to organize even more. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. An event that some dog mushers refer to as the premier dog race of the season is in trouble. Race organizers don't know yet where the North American sled dog race will be held. For the past 2 years, the three heats have started downtown. Before that, the race was held some miles out of town at the Jeff Studdard race grounds. The problem stems from what turned out to be a non-legal agreement between the local Dog Mushers Association and a group called the Friends of Alaskaland. Mushers had hoped to start their race, scheduled for March 14th, 15th, and 16th, from Alaskaland, where winter carnival activities will be held. The idea was to maximize attendance at both events and also increase gate receipts to offset the cost of putting on the race and its anticipated $13,000 purse. Larry Fitzgerald is president of the Alaska Dog Mushers Association.
The mushers like bringing the dog mushing to the people, really. We like running out of the city for a crowd that generates, you know, an enthusiasm. We think it's good for the city and good for sport, too.
It's also good for spectators, according to Association Secretary Jenny Sorensen.
The facilities, like at Alaskaland, would be a lot better as far as people having things to do while the races are out, before the race, after the race. Places, whether it's restrooms or other attractions going on, craft booths and things like that. So there's more for people.
The agreement reached between the mushers and the Friends of Alaskaland, a citizens group, called for the races to begin and end at Alaskaland, which is owned by the city, and for the mushers to charge a gate fee. But the contract was ruled invalid when it was determined that the city council must approve a gate fee by ordinance, which takes a month. The race is just 2 weeks away. So earlier this week, city manager Wally Droz, the Friends of Alaskaland, and the mushers decided that if the downtown merchants and other interested parties donated $10,000 toward the purse, the races will go downtown. Though there's still confusion about what the route might be, tentatively the teams would still leave from Alaskaland and then head downtown before going out to join up with the trail system used in all local preliminary races, trails that most mushers refer to as being among the best anywhere. The full $10,000 hasn't been collected yet, and the association just may move the races back out to the Jeff Studdard grounds, where gate receipts can be collected. Last year, merchants did not contribute toward the cost of the race, though Sorensen contends that they certainly make money from shoppers and imbibers. And as Fitzgerald says, that lack of a contribution hurt the association.
We put ourselves in a pretty good hold.
If the race is held at Alaskaland or downtown or a combination of the two, the city has agreed to help repair the streets and haul necessary snow. But weather conditions may force the race out of town anyway, according to Fitzgerald.
If situations arise through, you know, fault of weather, whatever, the trail is, we don't feel it's actually a safe trail for dog teams to be running on, we could at any time move the race back out to Jeff Studdard race grounds, you know, contingent on the trail conditions.
Okay, now let's look for the worst possible alternative, that the weather really continues to warm up and we've got breakneck conditions. Is any chance of canceling the race? Would it ever come to that?
Well, I think our trails are pretty good out Jeff Studdard anyway.
Yeah, I think they are too. I wouldn't say that there's absolutely no chance that we wouldn't cancel the race. I'd say that's highly unlikely because we feel our trail is in pretty good shape. But we wouldn't hold a race if we didn't feel it was safe to actually do it. You know, if we thought everybody would cripple up half their dogs and maybe half the mushers, we wouldn't hold the race.
The Fur Rendezvous sled dog race, held in Anchorage 2 weeks ago, was shortened, both in the length of the trail and in the number of days, due to trail conditions there. Some of the mushers felt the race shouldn't have been held at all, and a lot of the dogs, suffering from worn pads and torn toenails, probably would agree. But if local trail conditions are acceptable, the association expects at least 20 teams to enter the unlimited class, including a number of teams from outside. Local mushers to look out for include Dick Brunk, winner of this year's Fur Rendy race, Roxy Brooks, her dad, Gareth Wright, if he comes up with enough dogs, and, of course, Harvey Drake and George Atla. Outside mushers include Harris Dunlap of Baker's Mills, New York, second in this year's Fur Rendy race, Merv Hillpiper from Cedar Falls, Iowa, Dick Moulton from Center Harbor, New Hampshire, and 68-year-old Dr. Roland Lombard of Wayland, Massachusetts. Competition should be very tight.
Actually, to finish in the top 10 in this race is quite an achievement, really.
The Unlimited, wherever it's finally held, isn't the only one of the North American sled dog races. Jenny Sorensen says there's more.
The seven dog and the freight class are on the 7th, 8th, and 9th of March. That's the weekend before. That'll be run at Jeff Studdard Racetrack.
and we figure in the seven dog somewhere between, anywhere between 30 and 40 teams for that. The competition in the seven dog has been real tight all year. And we think there's probably just one team from outside that we know of that's coming up. Other than that, it'll be teams from around here or possibly open teams putting in a seven dog team and things like that.
The purse on that race is $3,000, and six or seven teams are expected to compete in the freight race, held the same weekend as the seven-dog class. They will be going for a $500 purse or more if the money can be raised. The junior mushers will be racing this weekend, but that's only one of the three dog races scheduled for this weekend, with other races at North Pole and Nenana. George Atla is the defending champion at Nenana with a $6,000 purse, and at North Pole, the heat will be on Harvey Drake, defending title holder there. That race has a $3,500 purse. Dick Brunk will be sitting this one out, so fans of the official state sport will have to wait two more weeks to see the three of them square off, wherever in Fairbanks the race is finally held.
People really should realize what we have here in this race. Bar none, it's a top race probably in the world, in the sprint racing class of dog mushing. You know, the fur rendezvous maybe might get a little more publicity and attention, but you just ask the mushers what's the toughest race to win, and they'll tell you it's the North American.
Larry Fitzgerald of the Alaska Dog Mushers Association. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.